The sexual revolution has sparked shelves full of books on sex techniques, how-to books. The Pleasure Bond is not such a book. Dr. William Masters and Virginia Johnson wrote it to make the results of their scientific studies of human sex available to the general reading public. We're visiting them all week on All Things Considered, and tonight they talk about what's wrong with the technique books. Dr. Masters.
The great trouble is, for most of us, is that we, again, as numbers-oriented culture, if someone will just give us a book that says step 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5...
We're sure we can go make it happen.
We'll go make it happen. And the tragedy of this is that we immediately become unimaginative. We immediately follow steps 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. You know, most of these sex manuals, practically all of them, that have to do with how to stimulate the female. And they're inevitably written by males, mm-hmm. who also have the vaguest idea of what they're talking mm-hmm. about. So that they're designed primarily to help the male assume a responsibility that he really in no way can assume, namely responsible for his female partner. But in any event, what they really do is he develops, quote, he develops a technique. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and maybe to 5.
Sounds like Arthur Murray dances.
Yeah, and it isn't long before his partner joins him on 1 and
She's
does
camp.
The marketing list 2, 3, and 4, and hopefully joins him again on 5.
Yeah. On the other hand, you also somewhere make the point that sex needs to be learned, just as reading does or writing does, that especially for the young girl,
she needs to learn
the enjoyment, the physical sensual enjoyment of a sexual experience. Don't these techniques help, at least as a first step towards that, to make you aware?
Learning is not the thing. Evolving, an opportunity to realize and exercise in a context of give and take, yes. But, and that is a learning. The semantics are all right,
yeah.
But the implication too often leads us astray when the idea is that we can go read about it and do it. Because most books, most writers, and I think we would, if we sought to write the same thing, we would fall victim of the same pitfall, is that it's very hard to tell people how to do something and not wind up subtracting that terribly important thing, themselves from it, the kind of viable expression of themselves, the opportunity to think and to learn what their own preferences are. Not on a long haul, because a preference isn't known until you're right there. What do you want? What do you think and feel at that moment?
It's really almost a cookbook approach, isn't it?
One
recipe gives you half a teaspoon of salt.
Basically impersonalized, and then we're back to the individual satisfying or satiating himself or herself rather than any major attempt at a relationship enhancement.
But didn't your own clinical work bring to light some of these possible techniques?
Well, there's no question that we would have to be call ourselves responsible for some of this. But I think there's a difference. The first textbook, it's almost 9 years old now, was indeed a physiology textbook.
Nobody believed it, though. Everybody wanted to rush and read it.
It was a physiology. Well, as a matter of fact, they might have wanted to rush and even buy, but they couldn't read very well, because that is one of
four syllable words.
That is one of the most illegible, or unreadable, rather, books that ever written, and it was written that vein purposefully. But in any event, when people did read this, they learned a lot of information about themselves that hopefully that they didn't know.
Well, about the physiology of their
bodies. And it is inevitably true that if you're talking about how something works, then one has to have a somewhat of a mechanical orientation. But in no sense, at any time or under any circumstances, did we suggest that developing some information primarily to know what happened so we could treat those that it wasn't working very well for, which was the reason the information was created. In no sense did we suggest that therefore we can all become a culture of mechanics.
Yeah. I think you object very much to goal-oriented sex, this whole idea of how many orgasms one can have, to what extent will one reach mutual climax.
Well, the mutual climax is something else again, too, which is also detrimental. But the sadness is, of course, that goals tend to wipe out the whole quality, all the things that you do to get there, which is living, which is the pleasure, which is the fun of getting there. Endpoint release in any occasion, wonderful though it may be, is a very brief thing. But even that endpoint release takes on intensity, takes on duration, takes on subjective quality and appreciation by virtue of what goes into it. Whether that what is a memory or the what is the kind of activities and sharing that has preceded it by the minutes or the hours or whatever that has gone before.
Relationship and communication.
That's right. The whole sum total that goes in there. The mood of the moment. You know, to be sexual when you're sad would be, you know, that takes on another color than to be sexual when you're terribly elated about something. And that's where dullness mm-hmm. goes by the board. That's how sex can remain fresh and new. And that's the thing that's missed almost totally by people who insist on orienting it to goals, you know, to bashes, to festivals, to these one moment in time. There's nothing wrong with black negligees if they mean sexual intrigue to people. But if you have to depend on it, that's a crutch.
Yeah.
That's my husband's favorite word. Anything that becomes a crutch to the achievement of a natural function, which sex is not only unnecessary, but we fail to see how it's really very useful.
Virginia Johnson and her husband and partner, Dr. William Masters. Tomorrow, in the final conversation in this series, a discussion of the influence of the women's liberation movement on sexual relations in America.